frequently use the notion of, well, we frequently talk about entropy. But as an analyst, for me, entropy means metrical entropy. I don't refer to entropy in an ergodic sense. So what I want to talk about is basically a parallel of the theorem of Furstenberg on actions of you take action multiplication. The typical example is the 2-3 multiplication on tori. So the results of Furstenberg and then also results of Rudolf and Johnson conjectures related to invariant measures. And, well, what I want to talk about is some further development of that, which is in a non-abelian setting. And the amazing thing is that somehow in the non-abelian setting, because basically your groups are larger, you can solve these problems quite nicely and, in fact, up to the end and unconditionally. So that will be most of the talk, but then what turns out is that somehow you can use the same kind of ideas to give other proofs of whatever was known in the abelian setting, which are going to give you statements that are quantitative and somehow completely disconnected from ergodic theory. Now, somehow, those work in ergodic theory, they may not like that much, but since I don't know too much ergodic theory, having purely harmonic analysis proofs of it somehow demystifies certain things that were kind of mysterious, at least for a long time. Also, especially due to the fact that in the abelian setting, these groups being very small, somehow these questions, whether they are right or not, whether the answers are positive or not, seem to be quite resistant, but I will come back on that later. Now, so let me state you a few theorems. Basically, these are problems that were posed by Furstenberg, independently Margulis, and fall in the general framework of describing measures that have certain invariance properties under actions of groups. We are going to approach them mainly with harmonic analysis techniques, but there's going to be a significant input of what you may call additive combinatorics. And what will turn out there is that somehow the sum product theorems are kind of a shadow of a more general principle, which will be stated in the form of a projection theorem and will play a crucial role there. No, how do I use that? I put this thing here. Can one enlarge that, or this is basically the best one can do with it? I don't know if that is... I will read whatever is... Ah, you do that like that. Maybe it works. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. That looks perfect. Okay. So what is the general framework? Well, we are taking a group gamma in SLD, Z, which is Zariski dense in SLDR, so you can let gamma operate on the d-dimensional torus. Now here I'm looking at actions on tori, and I'm going to use Fourier analysis, but like one of my co-authors specified, there is no absolute need for having access to Fourier analysis, and one may use this kind of techniques probably also to do things in a more general context. So what I have to start from is a measure mu on the d-dimensional torus, which is invariant under the action of that group gamma, which is a strong assumption, but we're going to weaken this assumption a little later. So then what you want to say is that basically this measure mu is of a rather simple structure, and so there are two possibilities. Either it is a trivial measure, it is the Haar measure, or it is a measure which is an atomic measure supported by rational points, or it is a combination of these things. So I assume there is key density, but you can weaken this assumption and just require that if you take the Zariski closure of gamma as a subgroup of SLBR, then it acts strongly reducibly and contains a proximal element. These are standard notions from the theory of random matrix products. I will come back on that later. So strong reducibility means that every finite index subgroup acts irreducibly. And proximality, which is, well, unfortunately something which is used in this theory quite strongly, you have talking about a proximal element when there is simplicity of the top exponent, the top eigenvalue. As I said, the assumption of having the invariance is a bit strong. And there is another notion, which is stationarity, which is more appropriate. So what we're doing here, this is the following thing. What I will consider now is set of generators for my subgroup gamma. More precisely, so what I have is a probability measure nu on SLDZ, and I will say, so first I will define a convolution between that probability measure nu on SLDZ and the measure mu on the d-dimensional torus by just doing the following. You have the measure mu, and you can look at the pull forward by the elements G in the support of nu, and then you just average them according to the weight nu. So instead of looking at measures nu, which are invariant under the group, I can start with a probability measure nu, and say, for our sake, to make it simple, just take a finitely supported one and symmetric, say, but it's not absolutely essential. I can take such a probability measure which support is generating my group gamma and say that mu is nu stationary provided nu convolved with mu is equal to mu. So there is a notion introduced by Furstenberg of stiffness. You say that the action of gamma on x, or gamma here is my group in SLDZ, x is my torus, you say that it's stiff if for any new stationary measure where nu is such a probability measure on gamma which support is generating gamma. Well, what you require is that every measure mu on x which is nu stationary is necessarily also gamma invariant. Now that's not so useful, but since it turns out we have a good description of the gamma invariant measures by the previous result, eventually what you're getting here is in fact also a description of the stationary measures. So the theorem is the following. Let nu be a probability measure on SLD Z so that the group generated by its support is as in theorem 1. So for instance, is there is key dense in SLDR. There is a condition here, but forget about that. Basically, you can take new finitely supported. Somehow one of my co-authors insisted on having this more general setting, perhaps because the problem was presented like that. Well, then any new stationary measure mu on the d-dimensional torus is gamma invariant, and therefore it is the superposition of the Haar measure and an atomic measure which is living on rational points. So this is the problem Furstenberg was posing in the special context, I believe, of SLDZ, because let me tell you that even if you assume the following, so you take a probability measure nu on SLDZ, which generates all of SLDZ. So let's forget about the risky dense subgroups. Let's just assume that the group generated by the support of nu is all of SLDZ. Then what I get in particular is that if mu is a measure on the d-dimensional torus which is nu stationary, then mu satisfies this property of being a superposition of Haar measure and atomic measure on rational points. Well, I would say that even that statement, I mean that statement where nu generates all of SLDZ, is basically as difficult to prove as the case which I was describing more generally of a measure generating a Zariski dense group. And the reason is that this nu can be generating SLDZ in a rather wild way. And in particular, say, if you're looking at the invariant measure on the projective space, the dimension of this measure can be quite small. So the way Furstenberg was phrasing the problem was really in the special case where the support of nu is SLDZ, but essentially, at least with this approach, it's almost equally difficult to treat the SLDZ case as that of the Zariski dense subgroups. Now there is another problem, because this may say is not extremely useful by itself, but there is a version which is quantitatively much more pleasing, and in fact it answers the problem of Givarch. So you can ask really what is happening with this random walk. So we want to say something more quantitative. So what I'm doing is the following. I would start with a point X in the d-dimensional torus, and then I start looking at the orbit of that point under the convolutions of nu. So here my measure, you just start with the Dirac measure at some point X, and then you convolve with nu, iterate n-fold convolution. Nu was the measure on SLDZ. So you get a sequence of measures nu n on TD. And now, what does it really mean in terms of equidistribution? Well, there is the following statement, that if you assume you have a large Fourier coefficient, so assume mu n hat A is bigger than delta for some A in ZD non-zero, then this can only happen when X admits a rational approximation in the following form. So X has to be exponentially close to a rational P over Q, where, moreover, there is a control of Q in terms of delta. So Q is less than, the size of A, say, divided by delta at the power C. Now, all these constants, of course, they depend on nu. So I will say something more about that in a moment, but let me just point out the following corollary, which is what you may... Well, there has been various theorems like that, but not exactly of in this setting. The equidistribution question of Givarch is the following, and this follows from the previous thing. We're taking a point, and then we're taking a typical sequence, G1, G2, etc., governed by the infinite product of nu. You can look at these probability measures on the d-dimensional torus, which is obtained by acting on X the automorphisms G1, G2, GK, either in the order G1, G2, GK, or you can also take them in the order GK, GK minus 1, etc., G1, it doesn't make any difference. And almost surely you're going to have convergence to the Lebesgue measure in the weak star sense, almost surely referring to the choice of the sequence G1, G2, etc. What I want to say about the first statement, this is not completely satisfactory as a statement. I'll tell you why. Essentially, you see, if you have a Fourier transform which is large, well, you can say that you are going to be close to a rational point with small denominator. Now, let us assume that x is actually equal to a rational point. Then, basically, what you do is that you reduce the measures mod q, and you are essentially in the context of an action of SLDQ. Now, assume that you have that nu has an expansion property, which people believe, which is reasonable to believe, then actually also when you are on these rationals, you're going to have, and so what I'm saying is that when x is such a rational point, also in that case you're going to have exponential, you're going to have bounds on the Fourier transform which are exponential in n. So that it may very well be that in fact when you're looking at basically the only thing that can go wrong in some sense is when x is really close to zero. When x, also when x is a rational, you would expect to have estimates on the Fourier transform which are exponentially small in n. So what I like to say is that your estimates are going to be always exponential in n, except in the situation where the point x where you're starting from is really exponentially close to zero. So in fact the description may be much simpler. So for instance when you take d equals 2, we know all this theory, but still there is a problem when x is not exactly rational but very close to a rational. So what I'm saying there is that whatever this statement may not be the true phenomenon that is going on there, but definitely for this for the equidistribution it is good enough. So the results I'm talking about are in a joint paper with Furman, Lindestrohs and Moses. They are intimately related to certain problems about invariant sets which for tori, for the abelian actions on tori, are known as Furstenberg's theorem and the later extensions of it, and for non-abelian actions have been studied by various people. So there is a notion there, I should go a little, there is a notion there of the ID property. So if you have a semigroup, a group or a semigroup in GLDZ, you say that you have, acting on a d-dimensional tori, say that you have the ID property if any gamma orbit is either finite or dense. Now, there has been a lot of study about that in the abelian setting, also in the non-abelian. In particular, in our setting, there is a result, there are results, there is a collection of results by various authors. I will be rather loose here about the credits. People who have been involved in that are Mushnik, Starkov, Givarch, etc., which tells you that if gamma, a subgroup of SLDZ, generates an is a Zariski dense subgroup of SLDR, then it has the ID property. Now, the interest of dealing with the stationary, basically the characterization of stationary measures, is that the statement which is there about ID property is a consequence of the statement about stationary measures. Why is it like that? Because if you have an invariant compact in the d-dimensional torus, it's going to carry a measure which is stationary with respect to your nu. Well, you can, if I give you a nu, you can make such a measure, but it's not necessarily so that it will carry a measure which is invariant under the full group. So So a posteriori from the characterization of stage three measures, you're going to have the characterization. You're going to have basically the characterization of the invariant sets and the ID property. Now, for simplicity, I'm going only to treat to deal with the case D equals 2. There are not so much substantially different things going on, unlike in the previous talk, for D bigger than 2, but it will simplify a little bit the notation and also the exposition. In that case, of course, the risky density just means that it contains a free subgroup. So the ingredients of the proof, what I liked very much is that somehow, despite the pressure of some of my co-authors to move the problem to an ergodic setting, which I could resist for a while, it turned out that ergodic theory is not really absolutely essential, and in fact is not quite necessary to treat that problem, and that, well, also, if you're only a harmonic analyst, you can do these things. In fact, the point is that when you are in a situation of having transformations which are non-commuting, there is no good notion of entropy somehow which captures the thing for your non-commuting transformation. Entropy is good if you have one transformation or commuting transformations. I mean, ergodic theoretical entropy. But if you have non-commutation of these transformations, it's not completely obvious to use them. So basically, these are going to be harmonic analysis techniques. Now, there is one important new ingredient, which is the whatever combinatorial number theory part, if you want to call it like that, which is a new projection theorem. And there is also what I'm going to use, the standard theory of random matrix products. So you will see how that thing fits together. Now, this projection theorem tells you the following. This is a qualitative statement in terms of the Hausdorff dimension, but really what we need is box dimension eventually. So I'll state it here in the language of Hausdorff dimension, where apparently already there it's not known, but I don't exclude that for that statement there may be a much softer proof. It's a little bit the situation like with the Edgar Miller proof of the Erdős ring theorem, and then what you really need in a more metrical sense, which is a statement in terms of box dimension. Somehow these proofs are not exactly on the same technical level. But even for Hausdorff dimension, the situation did not seem to be a known thing. So this is some kind of Marston-type projection theorem. It tells you the following. You have a set A in R times R. You can do it in any dimension you want. It has a certain Hausdorff dimension. So obviously, if you start projecting this set, say you have the set in R2, well, you're going to have projections which are at least of half dimension. But then you want to have a little bit more than half dimension. And what it turns out is that the directions where you don't get a little bit more than half dimension, they are really very small in a dimensional sense. So in other words, if I fix you a kappa, and I'm looking at the projections, the directions theta, for which that the corresponding projection has a dimension which is less than eta. So I'm looking at the directions theta for which the projection is going to be less than eta, where eta is a number which is a little bit larger than alpha over 2. Well, these directions are going to have a dimension which is less than kappa. And by taking eta sufficiently close to alpha over 2, I can get this kappa as small as I want. So I don't know if there is another approach to that than going the hard way. But in any case, I believe to treat the metrical setting where you use box dimension instead of Hausdorff dimension, likely you will have to do some more quantitative analysis. And in particular, what is underlying it, in fact it also implies it, it's the metrical setting of the sum product theorem for finite fields, which corresponds to the discretized ring theorem for sets of real numbers. Now, this is not exactly the same product for sets of real numbers. This is the same product for the entropy version. So we are not talking about cardinality of sets, we are talking about entropy of sets. So I will give you some details about that. So let me give you a quick outline of how this argument is going to work. Well, we are going in a very brutally, in a very brutal fashion, like you may, the way you may call an obvious harmonic analysis attempt to understand such measures. So what we do is that we assume we have a large Fourier coefficient of this measure mu on the torus. What I have is mu hat b, which is non-zero, so that is fixed for some b. I know my mu is stationary, so I can wrap the stuff around by taking the action of my measure mu and also the convolutions of mu. And so from the first statement, what you get is that an average of Fourier coefficients, mu hat gb, where g runs in the support of the r-fold convolutions of mu, is, well, it's going to be the same. So if I put absolute values inside, it's going to be at least this fixed value c, which is gotten by looking at mu hat b. Now, here you already see that you are in better shape than in the abelian situation. That is going to give you right away a lot of Fourier coefficients. What you are going to have, certainly, is that when you're taking the Fourier coefficients n, the frequencies n for which the Fourier coefficient is bigger, say, than 1/2 c, you're going to have a power. So you're taking the n less than capital N, the frequencies within a ball of radius n, with mu hat n bigger than whatever c over 2, it's going to be a power of n. Now, if that power is sufficiently large, it would be easy to finish the argument, because if, say, delta would be very close to 2, it would really mean that the measure mu is concentrated on a few points in the torus. But on the other hand, you also have the stationarity of mu, so think about it as invariance, under the action of mu. So if you have one point that carries some mass in the torus, you wrap it around with mu, you're going to have a lot of points. And that is not going to be compatible to the property that the measure has to be concentrated on a few points, or has a large, very large mass on a few points. But to do that, delta has to be sufficiently close to 2. And this you don't have. Also note that if you're looking at the set of these large Fourier coefficients, unlike you are in an abelian setting, I'm going to come back on that, this set is quite unstructured. So we like to put some structure in the set of these big Fourier coefficients, and this is in fact the main step. It's how to get this structure inside. So this structure is going to use the two techniques I mentioned to you, which is this projection theorem and also the random matrix products. So what I'm going to put you on here is really the main lemma of that story, and I'm going to try to explain you what it means. So what you have is the following. I'm going to consider the set F of frequencies within a ball of size n, which have a large Fourier, for which I have a large Fourier transform. So mu hat k bigger than beta for k in F. Of course, this set F can be rather small, but what it turns out is that essentially F has maximal entropy, in my sense, with respect to an appropriate scale. So what is written there is that you have a set F of elements of Z2 or Zd in general. So we are here in the D equals 2 case. So these elements are, these Z2 elements are of norm bounded by n. They are separated by an amount which is at least n at the power 1 minus kappa. Now, how many such elements can you have? Well, at most, n at the power 2 kappa. So what it tells you is that basically you have a maximal number of it. In other words, the metrical entropy, which is defined as the covering number of your set by both of the corresponding size, well, the metrical entropy of these large Fourier coefficients is going to be maximal at scale m, which is n at the power 1 minus kappa. So roughly the picture is that you have this ball in Z2, which is of size n, and then you cut this thing in boxes which are of size n1 minus kappa, and in each of these, not in each of these boxes, but in most of these boxes, at least in a fraction of these boxes, you can find a frequency with a large Fourier coefficient. So usually this game, that's what the harmonic analysis does, it just goes from the Fourier transform side to the physical space and back and tries to bootstrap the information he has. So what is the meaning of that on the level of the physical space? Well, it implies what we called granulation. So granulation is the beginning to the construction of a rational grid which is going to carry a fraction of the measure, but at this stage we are quite far from that yet. So the lemma which is here is a very elementary harmonic analysis lemma, which is the right kind of thing to give in a course, a beginning course of harmonic analysis. So we have a situation where the metrical entropy of the large Fourier coefficients, so I'm looking at the places where the mu hat is bigger than kappa 1, so we are looking at the set of these large these frequencies in the ball of radius n, and the entropy at scale m, assume that it is as large as possible. Here I wrote the lemma for general d, I mean it is true as well for d equals 1 as d equals 2 as anything, and the proofs are all the same. Let's assume that it is maximal. Now if you have this situation, what does it mean on the level of the physical space? Well, you can find points xi, number of points, I don't care how many, they are separated by 1 over m, and if I take the masses of the union of the balls at these points of radius 1 over n, I get a fraction of the full mass. In other words, what I can do is capture a fraction of the full mass on the union of balls of radius 1 over n and with centers which are at much greater distance because they are at distance 1 over n. And in our application, the capital M was n at the power 1 over kappa. So that's already the beginning of the thing. What I'm getting there is a fraction of the measure on both which are of small radii and with centers very much separated. This is what we call granulation. Now this granulation is not quite enough, but what is not too hard, using again the invariance or the stationarity, is to improve on this granulation and actually get these radii even much smaller compared with the separation. So this is an easy, I wouldn't call it even a bootstrap, but an easy application now of the group structure again. So we were starting from centers which are separated by an amount 1 over n at the power 1 minus kappa. The balls, they have radii 1 over n at the beginning, but what you can do is transform these balls in ellipses, start intersecting these ellipses and get smaller and smaller balls without too much, this is not completely trivial but it can be done, without too much ruining the separation of the centers. So what you can do using the group action is to keep the separation, say 1 over n, 1 minus kappa, in particular 1 over n, of centers and get the radii decreased to any power, any given power of 1 over n. Of course, if you want to increase the constant here, the exponent here, the fraction of the measure is going to go down, but we stop at some point. in a way, what we are doing now is going towards a statement that the measure should be zero-dimensional. But we don't have to go all the way. We don't have to do that. We stop at some point, because at that point we can do a rational approximation, which is also completely straightforward. Before, I was using an expander argument, but you don't have to use that. It's much more elementary. Look, what we're having here are balls which carry a significant amount of the measure. So you have radius epsilon, you have a ball BX epsilon of radius epsilon, which is carrying an amount of measure which is epsilon at the power tau, where this tau can be made arbitrarily small. I think I made a mistake. So now you have to hold your head a little bit different. Here we go. So what I'm doing is that I just make a rational approximation to the center. So the center is x, I get a rational point A over Q. You can do a rational approximation like that with a, since you are saying 2D here, with an error which is 1 over Q square root of N. In particular, if I enlarge the ball a little bit by shifting the center x to the rational A over Q, with radius now which is 2 over Q square root of N, I still capture the original ball, so I have at least epsilon to the power 2. Then you use again the stationarity, implying that if you wrap this ball around using the action of the group, you're still going to have at least epsilon to the power 2. Well, if you have a rational, if you take centers, if you start with a center A over Q and you apply the group, you're still going to remain in the set of rationals of the form B over Q. You're going to increase the radius with the factor which is the norm of G, but we keep the norm of G small enough so that these balls are going to be disjoint. So I take my R of the order of the logarithm of N in order to ensure that say the norm of G divided by square root of N is still less than a half. The bottom line is that you find that the sum of the measures over all the balls, so I have the measure of the ball centered at B over Q with radius 1 over 2Q, all these balls are disjoint, and weighted with the, well, you have to look at the return probability here, so this is the measure nu R of the set of elements G in my group, for which that GA, A was the original center, is equal to B, that is going to be bigger than epsilon to the power 2. Now, from a very weak gap, if you want, very weak gap information, what you can say is that these new R measures are going to be smaller than some power of 1 over Q, and this power only depends on my random walk. So what I'm getting is that epsilon tau is less than Q minus omega for some omega. Tau can be taken as small as I want, but fixed from the previous construction. And the conclusion is that, in fact, the Q has to be quite small compared with 1 over epsilon. So what we are getting is a fraction of the measure which is going to live on the union of balls centered at rationals. So you should read the last statement here if you can. What I'm getting here is the following. I'm getting a fraction of my measure which is on the union of the balls BAQ with, let me write it down. So this is the basic statement here. I consider the set sigma Q epsilon, which is going to be the union over, well, you're going to take balls BA over Q epsilon. And this union is over all Q less than capital Q and AQ relative prime, where Q is small compared with epsilon. So what I'm taking here is a Q, say, which is 1 over epsilon, at the power 1 over 20 or something like that. So what I'm getting is that the measure has a fraction of its weight on such sets. And now the final step to get the rational atoms is actually to decrease. I should do it at some stage, keep my Q fixed and decrease epsilon further to zero, and in such a way that by decreasing epsilon I don't lose much of the measure on sigma Q epsilon. So this is also a rather straightforward step, which is summarized here. So we are starting from sigma Q epsilon carrying some fraction of the measure. Then we are taking an n which is not too large, say controlled in terms of the logarithm of 1 over epsilon. What you have by stationarity is that if mu sigma Q epsilon is large, also the convolution of mu with mu n is going to be large. Now if you have this information and you see what it really means, what you can do is replace the epsilon in the sigma Q epsilon by an epsilon prime without losing too much of the measure, and where epsilon prime is significantly smaller than epsilon by a factor e at the power minus cn. And that can be iterated, of course, until you eventually are going to prove that the rationals A over Q themselves are going to carry a fraction of the measure, which is the final statement. How much time do I have? Not much, huh? 2 minutes? I started, yeah. So 7 minutes, right? Okay. Let me skip the stuff on random walks, because this is rather standard. Let me give you the projection theorem in the metrical setting. So what is used is the following property, which is deduced from this discretized string theorem. We'll not have the time to recall it. So this is the same statement, but in the language of box dimension. What we have is a probability measure that basically governs the directions on which you can project. Where does this probability measure come from? Well, you see, if you have this random matrix product, you get a stationary measure on the projective space. So that's a different stationary measure. That's the one on projective space. And this has a certain dimension. So this capital P corresponds to the stationary measure on projective space. Now, why do we have projection? Because basically, if you're going to apply on a set, say a set of whatever it will be, a set of integer points of, not integer, but elements of Z2, if you apply an element G of large norm, what counts really there is the expanding direction. And if you write down what it means, essentially you're going to have a projection. So you get a direct application of that statement, which tells you that if you have a set, so this is in metrical, in box dimension language, A is a union of delta squares, and delta is very small. And the number of these, what I assume is that the number of these boxes is delta to the power, sorry, is delta minus alpha. So the measure here, this is the Lebesgue measure of A, is delta to the power 2 minus alpha. Moreover, I have to assume that A is not sitting in a small ball, so I need to assume some kind of non-concentration property. And if you have that, what you can say is that you're going to have some direction in the support of my probability measure. And in fact, most of these directions are going to have the property that when you project the set A, you're going to get more than what would be the obvious thing, which is delta to the power 1 minus alpha over 2. You're going to have here delta to the power 1 minus eta, for some eta which is bigger than alpha over 2. Now, interestingly, this is not applied on the level of continuous sets. This is applied on the level of the discrete subsets of Z2, namely the sets of large Fourier coefficients, in order to get
a more structured set. Now, that is going to refer to projections, but say if you increase above a half the size of the projections, because the set of large Fourier coefficients has an additive structure, if you add them up, if you add them up again, then you're going to have for the full set again on the say on the entropy of the full set of large Fourier coefficients, except that the entropy here has to be introduced with respect to an a specific scale that is going to vary. So that is basically what is going on. Now, to give you one more transparency, what turns out is that with very much the same IDs, you can reprove the theorems of Furstenberg and Rudolf Johnson, in fact, in reverse order. And these statements, so these are the well-known problems about invariant sets for multiplication by 2 and 3 and the generalization of that. When you would have a billion actions of tori. So what it turns out is that what is underlying is a harmonic analysis lemma, which is extremely simple. I'm going to stop after that, as I am supposed to. So this is going to be essentially my last transparency. So you see, what I'm considering here is an abelian setting. I look just at the action of multiplication by A and multiplication by B on, say, on a one-dimensional torus. I assume that neither A or B divides the other one. It's not essential for this. Sorry, this is not the one I want. This is not a requirement necessarily, sorry, this is not a requirement of having A and B which are relative prime. So what we are having, this is the content of the Rudolph-Johnson theorem, we're having a measure mu on the torus. Just take any measure and assume the dimension of the measure is positive. So I'm having alpha dimensional measure on the torus. Now, what I will consider is a set sigma of integers which has the property that they are asymptotically dense. The set sigma, say, is going to come from looking at A to the K, B to the L. A and B, you can assume relative prime, but it's not essential, doesn't really make any difference. So that will imply that you have this non-lacunarity of the semigroup. But for our purpose, all I need is that. Now, note that this property is extremely strong in the sense of what we were discussing before, because it gives you maximal entropy, automatically maximal entropy at the right scales. So you like to conclude from that, especially that you have positive entropy here. So what you get, and this is a purely harmonic analysis statement, when you're taking the actions of the row n, of n multiplication, so x goes to nx on the torus, and you're looking at the image measures rho and mu, you can find in the convex hull of the rho and mu some element which is which is majorizing Lebesgue measure. So in particular, if I know that mu is invariant on a multiplication by 2 and 3, well, the rho and mu, they are all equal to mu, and what I'm finding is that mu is in fact controlling, is a majorant of Lebesgue measure. So what is interesting is that this is completely parallel to the things I was talking before, and it has, this is in fact a joint paper with Lindestraus, Michel, and Axley. What is the advantage of that in particular is that it gives you very precise quantitative statements which are completely controlled by this property, which can be made precise in terms of Baker's theorem, for instance, and you get some specific hands-on statement about how dense are the orbits. On the negative side, after you have seen the proof, you really get the impression that this Furstenberg problem is only scratched, and that the true answer is something which lies much deeper, perhaps on the level of Baker theory, or perhaps on the level of the subspace theory. I'm out of time, so I cannot say more.